This is Where We Live. I'm David DeRoche in for Lucy Nalpathanchel. One week after a mass gathering of white supremacists in Charlottesville, Virginia resulted in the death of a young woman, thousands rallied in Boston against hatred and bigotry. Today, we're talking about responding to hate. Later, we'll examine the most effective ways to counter extremism. But first, we wanted to get a historical perspective on where we are now as a country. How is it that we're seeing a resurgence in white supremacist gatherings? And what can our past teach us about where we're headed? Is white supremacy on the rise, or is it just more visible because of social media and the internet? You can join the conversation at 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at wnpr.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us by phone is David Blight. He's a professor of American history at Yale University. He's also the author of a Guardian piece called The Civil War Lies on Us Like a Sleeping Dragon, America's Deadly Divide and Why It Has Returned. Professor Blight, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you very much.
So in your recent piece that I just referenced, you talk about Abraham Lincoln, who once said that danger cannot come from abroad, that if destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of free men, we must live through all time or die by suicide. I mean, very strong language. And I guess the way I interpret that is he's saying that the sorts of things that in a free society that could bring it down need to come from within, because that's sort of the structure of a free society. Can you just explain your understanding of what he was saying and how that might be relevant to our situation we're facing today?
Yeah, well, Lincoln said that in 1838. It's one of his earliest public speeches, and we love to refer to it because it seems to be so prescient of much later, the Civil War that would come. Lincoln is saying that at a time when the United States really didn't have foreign enemies to speak of, but it had a growing, roiling, expanding internal problem over slavery. And it was Lincoln's way of saying, if this republic is ever to fall apart or die, it'll die internally. It'll come because republics turn on themselves. And he was not incorrect, of course. We eventually did a few decades later. It's a prescient warning even for today. Republics, democracies are messy, sometimes awkward, and sometimes very violent. And we've been all of those things.
And so you also talk about the politics of race in your piece. You talk about how as long as America has a politics of race, it will have a politics of Civil War memory. And I guess it might be hard for some people to understand that, because in one way we sort of need a politics of race, because there are still there still is systemic racism. There needs to be some sort of approach to address that. On the other hand, there is that the to your point that sort of continuing recalling of the Civil War based on the politics of race. So I'm wondering, what do you mean by that when you say that as long as America has a politics of race, it will have a politics of Civil War memory? And how do you think, and just expand on your thoughts you were mentioning earlier in terms of the Civil War continuing to influence divisions in our country today?
Well, I wrote a long book about this called Race and Reunion some 16 years ago. It is amazing to think now how it's more relevant now than it was then. That line about as long as we have a politics of race, we'll have a politics of how we remember the Civil War. Well, we've always had a politics of race. It's endemic. It's inherent to this society. It is our deepest dilemma. It's probably an eternal dilemma. We should never fool ourselves that there's some Shangri-La out there awaiting us on questions of race. But whenever race does explode, whenever we face yet another racial reckoning, which we are having now, it is remarkable how much the meaning of the Civil War, and now certainly its symbols and its results, come to the fore, just explode. Robert Penn Warren once said, "The Civil War lays around in American memory like unexploded grenades in the leaves. We never know quite when they're going to blow up." And that's exactly what seems to have happened now. Now, As to why this is happening now, there are many answers to that, but I would urge everyone to focus on what we might call the shock of events. Now, white supremacy has always been there. It comes, it goes. It is rising again in terms of organizations. The Southern Poverty Law Center has some extraordinary reports on this that show, particularly in the years of the Obama presidency, these groups proliferated, had a much wider voice because of the internet and so on. But all of our concern about Confederate monuments, memorials, symbols, most of it anyway, stems, we must admit, from the mass murder of 9 black people in a church in Charleston. That event made everybody reposition themselves to these symbols, whether they wanted to or not. There were plenty of members of the South Carolina legislature who voted to take down that Confederate flag on its Capitol grounds who never would have believed they'd ever live to do that. But events sometimes make us reposition ourselves. And now, of course, Charlottesville has. Every day, some new Confederate memorial or monument or name is being taken down. This morning's news is the University of Texas. Where will it be tomorrow? We respond to events. We're creatures of response and reaction, whether we like that or not. But we are living one of those reckonings again. And whenever we have these racial reckonings, we find out just how useful race is for people who want to use it, and especially for white supremacists. White supremacy is a malleable ideology. It can go over here and hide for a while, and then it breaks out again over there. It's always there, this kind of racial resentment or racially defined resentment. It's always there for Americans who want to use it. And of late, they, of course, have had a voice, let's be honest, a voice, a spokesman in high places. And leadership matters in determining what our normative behavior and non-normative behavior.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the Southern Poverty Law Center because we have somebody from them on in the next segment. So when you talk about these removal of statues as sort of a reaction to events that take place, do you find that is almost it could be considered an empty gesture in terms of just being reacting to a moment in time, whereas, to your point, white supremacy having always been a thing, the need to address it is sort of consistent, but an incident then sort of makes people react in pulling statues down. But does that really, what does that actually do to address white supremacy? As it almost seems like it emboldens them and empowers them rather than addressing systemic racism or systemic white or the rise of white supremacy.
Well, I wouldn't accuse anybody of an empty gesture without knowing them or knowing the local circumstances and so forth. But I do worry, as a historian in particular, historians' instincts are not to erase. We want everything out there to study. In fact, a lot of us are arguing now that as these monuments and memorials come down, we want a lot of them preserved somewhere. We don't want the record of this to just vanish so that people can't study it. However, on the gesture issue, here's what does worry me. In fact, I just read a quote in this morning's paper from the president of the University of Texas saying that his view of Confederate monuments just changed overnight because of what happened in Charlottesville. Now, I don't know the man, and so I don't want to cast aspersions without knowing his own background and so forth, whether he grew up in Texas or the South or wherever. But if it takes a Charlottesville to literally change your mind about monuments, you haven't thought much about American history. You haven't learned much American history. You haven't learned the basics of how this country put itself back together and forged a reconciliation around the Jim Crow system after the Civil War. What worries me is this, that so many mayors, governors, perhaps college presidents, and other kinds of leaders are rushing now in almost an atmosphere more of fear than of analysis. You know, fear rather than understanding or examination to remove these things, remove all these symbols. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these symbols and monuments, some large, some small, But to just rush to remove it and to do it in the middle of the night because you're afraid of the far right coming to your town or your city or your campus and holding some demonstration is not a reason to do it.
Isn't that sort of the problem, probably, is just overall lack of understanding of history? It seems like that is a problem that has plagued human beings throughout time. We tend to kind of repeat mistakes constantly, and we tend to experience the same kind of things over and over again. What's your understanding of our understanding of history? I mean, is that why you think it's important for people to understand what happened in the Civil War? And what kind of parallels maybe can we draw from then to now that could help us really understand
where
we are?
Sure. Well, if you ask a historian whether there's enough historical understanding out there, we will always say no, because it's our business. On the other hand, it's not just lack of knowledge of history. It's that we all grow up with, learn by some means, whether it's schooling or other public means, we learn narratives, we learn stories that we believe we live in. Everybody has a sense of history. Everybody has a sense of the past, at least through their families. And history really is about competing stories and competing narratives. And what the Lost Cause became, the Lost Cause tradition that was forged in the South in the wake of the Civil War and really took hold in the culture by the late 19th century, and even became a kind of a national tradition by the early 20th century, is a version of history. The Lost Cause was an ideology, mostly a racial ideology, in search of a history. So what we've got is millions of people who've come to believe certain narratives, certain stories. This is what drives the white supremacy movement in many ways. It's not just racial hatred. It is that. And it's a lot of cockamamie ideas about race. But it's also a narrative. It's a story. They believe America is a white supremacist nation. They believe it was founded on racial principles. They believe that white people are the core of American society, and they've lined up a history to support that. We are all creatures of the memories we grow up with, and then we just hope that we get educated and we get some of that memory dislodged by better history. And in some ways, it is incumbent on education, on schooling, on universities, and on my own profession of historians to reach out more, to get outside of the academy, to get outside of our schools, and to educate the public about this story of how the United States put itself back together after its most divisive experience, its bloodiest, most divisive experience in the Civil War, which resulted in 4 million slaves being freed and the U.S. Constitution being rewritten in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. But we ultimately put the Union back together on the backs of black people. We did it by creating a structure, a regime, an American apartheid, really, that placed those freed people and their sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters into a system of dead-end segregation. And this is why you're hearing so much in the news, at least by informed commentators, about why and how all these Confederate monuments, or the vast majority of them, about 80% of them, all went up between about 1890 and the 1920s. And that's roughly 30-year period. Not only did white supremacy take hold of the southern states and much of the north as well, but the Lost Cause ideology, the idea that the South had fought for a noble cause, that it fought for its home, it fought for heritage, and it was led by this great Christian soldier, Robert E. Lee, who was transformed by the early 20th century into a great American hero, not just a great Southern hero. And I would just say one last thing here. As we keep having this ongoing debate, and I have no idea where it's going to end, about what to do with Confederate iconography and memorials, the monuments that bother me most are the 12 Confederates inside the U.S. Capitol. Now, we know why they got there, because every state gets two. It's a product of states' rights, ironically. But Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee have statues in Statuary Hall inside the U.S. Capitol. They fought to destroy the American Union. But they cannot be removed without Congress doing it. So here's yet another challenge to this Republican-controlled Congress. Do they have the moral backbone to stand up and say Jeff Davis should come out of the U.S. Capitol? Haven't seen that happen yet. There is some movement toward that. But let's watch that to see where this monument mania ends up going.
You know, you talk about stories and narratives, and I grew up in Virginia, and one of the things that I remember hearing was that states' rights, the Civil War is fought over states' rights, and to this day, that's what people talk about. I'm David DeRoche. This is Where We Live. I'm in for Lucy Nalpathanchil today. We're talking about hatred and divisions in our country and confronting that hatred. Joining us is David Blight. He's a professor of American history at Yale University and author of the Guardian piece, The Civil War Lies on Us Like a Sleeping Dragon, America's Deadly Divide and Why It Has Returned. Thanks for joining us, Professor Blight.
You're welcome, David. Thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk about how to respond to hate. You can join the conversation 860-275-7266, email wherewelive@wnpr.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm David DeRoche, in for Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about confronting hate. What is the most effective way to stop bigotry in its tracks? Joining us now to talk about this from the studios of WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama, is Michael Harriet. He's a staff writer at The Root, and he's also author of a recent piece entitled Yes, Anti-Fascists Are Violent and Necessary. He's also host of the Black One podcast. And also with us from Montgomery, Alabama, is Leisha Brooks. She's Outreach Director for the Southern Poverty Law Center. We've got a strong Alabama contingent today, which is great, especially considering the Civil Rights Movement has deep roots there. Welcome to Where We Live, Michael and Leisha.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. You can also join the conversation at 860-275-7266, email wherewelive@wnpr.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We do have a caller on hold, but before I get to the caller, I would like to ask Michael. Michael, after the events in Charlottesville, we've been hearing a lot about the Antifa or anti-fascist movement. I mean, it's certainly been around for a while, but they've gotten a lot more media attention after the Charlottesville events and some of the events over the past year at Berkeley. Explain to us a little bit about this movement and what their views are on violence as a means to respond to fascism.
Well, I think one of the first words that comes up when you discuss Antifa is violence, and it is not really the crux of their movement. The movement it began in Europe during the Second World War, and they pledged to basically do anything possible. A lot of us know about the phrase "by any means necessary," which comes originally from the Antifa movement, and they pledged to do anything possible to stop fascism. What they saw with Hitler. And so what they say is that they have pledged to take direct action. And some people do it by activism. Some people do it by education. And some people do it through fighting back physically, which has been a component of every liberation movement that's been successful almost in history. So we see Antifa and we say violence, but it's not really the basis of their philosophy. What their philosophy is taking direct action to stop fascism or this nationalist agenda.
But what about the events that happened in Charlottesville, where we know that there was some violence that took place? There was, you know, you heard Donald Trump say that there's bad people on both sides. What about just violence as a means to gain social change in this context? I guess another way to ask that question would be, is bigotry itself or is hate speech itself enough to justify violence to achieve the end of that bigotry or hate speech? Or is violence only ethical or reasonable if it's in response to violence? What's your opinion on that? And how do you think Antifa would respond to that?
Well, what I would think Antifa would say is, I don't think that they're fighting hate speech, right? I think hate speech is the genesis of a lot of things, and one of them is hate. So I think if most of the people who are involved with Antifa, and it's hard to categorize it because it is by its nature a disparate group of people, right? And many of them are anarchists who don't follow any pledged agenda. So it is hard to classify it. But what I would say is that they are fighting hate, not hate speech. And I think if the people on the other side, the white supremacists, the neo-Nazis, I think if they were only there to talk about white supremacy, or if they only existed to talk about white supremacy, then I don't think Antifa would be involved as much as they are to stop the bombings, the lynchings, the systematic oppression of people of color and immigrants and different religions across the country. And I think that is what they use any tactic to stop, and not necessarily speech.
Mm. I want to turn to our guest from the Southern Poverty Law Center, Leisha Brooks. She's also outreach director at Southern Poverty Law Center. Leisha, I want to ask you some of the same questions. When we see, when Michael's talking about that white supremacists aren't just talking about hate, they are sort of being hate, or their goals are sort of the removal of people of color, and sort of, you know, what that looks like, and how that could inspire or justify using direct action or violent acts to stop that in its tracks. How does the Southern Poverty Law Center think about those sort of direct actions against hate or hate speech? What's your take on that?
Well, thanks for having us, David. First, I mean, each of us has a moral obligation to take a strong stand against fascism and white supremacy. We completely agree with that. The Southern Poverty Law Center, though, was really birthed out of the modern American civil rights movement. Julian Bond was our first president. We have a deep and abiding call to nonviolent protest. We believe in nonviolent protest. We also know that research and history shows us that reacting violently to neo-fascists or fascists will bounce back. We're just playing into the hands of the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists when we come back at them with violence. It will spiral into continued violence. We saw that happen in Nazi Germany. It gives rise to folks who see those pushing back against neo-fascism as the violent players. They seek chaos, and this is what the white supremacists seek. They seek to create chaos, they seek to present themselves as the victims, and they seek to gain public support through those strategies. So the Southern Poverty Law Center really stands by our call to nonviolent peaceful protests, similar to what we saw in Boston on Saturday.
So, Sherry, I wanted to ask, how do people confront, if people feel compelled to go to a white supremacist rally because they feel like they cannot allow somebody to come to their town, but when you're confronted with that sort of hatred and bigotry, how do people who feel compelled to go, how would they maintain some sense of composure, not feel like they have to actually interact or get violent with that group? I know it's kind of a tough question. I don't know if anybody, Michael, maybe you have some suggestions on that. How are people able to actually go see these groups and then maintain some sort of self-control when they're confronting such anger and hostility and hatred?
Well, I think there is a multifaceted approach. Now, when we talk about the civil rights movement, we know that we always talk about the marches and the sit-ins and things of that nature. But what we forget about was that Martin Luther King and the NAACP and the Southern Community for Nonviolence, they they had these training sessions all over the country before every event, before every march, before the March on Washington, before they crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. They had these training events, and they spoke to the people. They trained them on how to carry out the actions of nonviolence. So we often look at it as just a series of marches and forget about the education that went along with it. And as far as your question, I think that it is hard to ask people to respond to hate and nonviolence in their faith, in their face, by resisting the same. So I think we have to have this education with groups that are committed to nonviolence. I think, you know, that we talk about the multifaceted approach. We have to talk about voting. We have to, you know, because just being at a protest might not solve this problem. So you have to talk about community goals, voter registration. We have to talk about the people who actively work year-round to confront these groups individually, right? The people who go and educate people about hate groups, the people who go and educate people about anti-Semitism, the people who work with police departments to stop it, and a lot of it, as we see with every movement, is talking to the people that are in the periphery of these movements and saying, look, if you see something or if you know something, you have to contact law enforcement. Because, again, we're not just talking about speech. We're talking about physical violence from the parts of white supremacists. We're talking about, you know, the bombings of mosques and temples. We're talking about, you know, hangings. We're talking about police violence. We're talking about KKK members being embedded in law enforcement agencies. So we have to take these specific actions to fight all of these separate incidents of hate.
Mm. This is Where We Live. I'm David DeRoshan for Loosened Up with Anshul. Today we're talking about hatred and divisions in our country and confronting that hatred. Joining us is Alicia Brooks. She's an outreach director for the Southern Poverty Law Center, and Michael Harriet. He's a staff writer at The Root. I wanted to get to a caller really quick. Sherry is calling from Danbury. Go ahead, Sherry. You're on Where We Live.
Oh, hi. I am a white woman. I married a black man in 1970. And as your first guest said, I have seen the waxing and waning of hate in America, sometimes feeling unsafe, sometimes just being aggravated. Sometimes my daughter was refused services in Virginia because she was of mixed race at a doctor's office. But what I can't emphasize enough is that none of this could happen without that vast majority of people who are on the line and who say nothing. It's not the far right or the far left. They'll always be with us. But the everyday person has to say, when they hear something, say something, but they don't know what to say. So what I'm telling you has worked for me, and I would encourage others to do, is say something very simple. Why would you say that? So if they say something racist or against a religion or against some other minority, to say, why would you say that? And no matter what they say, say, why would you say that? It makes all those people in the middle come up short.
Mm. That's a great point, Sherry. I think also it's probably important to point out that people who are nice or never consider themselves to be a racist often have sort of subconscious biases that might make them actually racist in ways that they couldn't recognize. I think people are talking about unconscious and subconscious biases and how do we recognize those? And I think Sherry made a good point. If somebody recognizes that, point it out. I think that people won't know that they're being racist unless somebody actually points that out. I don't know, Alicia, or would you have any response to that? What are your thoughts on just how people can make little decisions in day-to-day lives to sort of confront bigotry and hatred?
I appreciate the caller's suggestion. The Southern Poverty Law Center has a publication called Speak Up Against Everyday Bias and Bigotry that has just those suggestions around that theme. Line of thinking. It's kind of ways to intervene with family, at the workplace, in a store, with strangers, I think research shows it's very important to kind of think about these things in advance and think about how one might respond when confronted with biased or bigoted or racist statements, or, you know, you see someone being harassed. It's very important to think about what your response will be in advance so that you're able to respond in the moment. Mm-hmm. So all of those resources, in addition to our 10 Ways to Fight Hate, are on our website, and they're all free and able to download today.
So that's at the Southern Poverty Law Center's website. I want to get to one more caller. Daniel is calling from New Britain. Go ahead, Daniel. You're on Where We Live.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I just read an article by Pat Buchanan, If We Erase Our History, Who Are We? And it speaks to exactly the topic of conversation here. And I think the president just asked very honestly, you know, how far does this go? Because at the end of the day, we're in an identity crisis in the West. And I think it's hypocritical if we don't just accept the fact that starting with the explorers, even before the foundation of the country, you know, French, Spanish, Portuguese, they were all white supremacists by the terminology being used, this Orwellian narrative being spun by the media, that anybody who wants to preserve the culture of the West and the foundation at a biological basis is a racist, white supremacist, neo-Nazi. And I mean, the founding fathers would all fit into that category as well. So are we going to tear the whole thing down? How far does this go? And there should also be a realization that the left has their own violence. The man that tried to kill Scalise was a reader of the Southern Poverty Law Center, as well as a Black Lives Matter sympathizer that killed the five cops in Dallas. So it's on both sides, and that's all the president was saying. And I think this reaction is so completely overblown. It's actually dividing the country more, because you're taking all the Trump voters and you're basically calling them Nazis now. So I don't know where this ends. Maybe a second civil war. Hopefully not.
Well, Daniel, I appreciate the call.
I think that that's just a fascinating response. I mean, it's interesting that you would say that it's all overblown, and then the caller is able to come up with, you know, kind of all these things that are apparently already kind of resting in his heart and mind. The Southern Poverty Law Center issued a report after the massacre in Charleston, South Carolina, when we began to look anew at Confederate monuments and memorials. We, just like the professor that preceded us on the show, we're not trying to remove history. We're trying to move these monuments to a false history, to a place of education, to museums, to archives. We take issue with them being placed in public space where people who were and continue to be harmed and reminded of a history of inequality and oppression. And I would say that we're very selective in what history we choose to memorialize. I would remind the caller that, you know, we think nothing of tearing down sacred burial grounds at Standing Rock or memorials to people of color who have long made important contributions to the country. But some folks just want to concentrate on the so-called heroes of the lost cause of the Confederacy.
Mm. Right. And one thing I'd like to add is this idea of the Western culture and celebrating Western culture. If you look at Germany, I don't think there's any group of people who are more aware of their history and their culture than Germans. And they don't celebrate their Nazi past. It's illegal to have a Nazi symbology in public. They don't have Nazi statues. They put them in museums. And I don't, this idea that, you know, history, unless it's on a sidewalk in front of your town square, is erased, is just a false idea, right? Because, you know, there are millions of towns across America. Most towns don't have this symbology of white supremacy in public. And somehow they know about the Civil War. Somehow they know about American history. So it's just a false narrative. And as far as, you know, the violence on the left and the right, like, I think that everyone involved, you know, that's a false narrative, too, because they say it as if, like, the left is happy that Steve Scalise was shot. as much as the right was happy as nine people were killed in a Charleston church. And I don't think either side, the left or the right, was happy about that, right? So both sides should be working towards erasing this hate from the public consciousness, and not just the speech again, but the actions.
Mm. We've got a lot of callers coming in. I want to get to Marcy is calling from New Haven. Marcy, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hey, it's Mercy, like Lord have, actually.
Oh, forgive me.
No worries. So I'm actually calling in response to the last caller and his misconception of what white supremacy is. So white supremacy, as it's being spun today, is an allegiance to Western culture, which is actually absolutely not the case. White supremacy, it stems from whiteness, the creation of whiteness, which was created for the sole purpose of dividing the cultures and creating a system of oppression against people of color and creating this supreme identity for individuals who are white. Something that I say all the time when I'm having conversations about race is that I think white people or individuals who identify as white need to redeem the culture that whiteness actually stole from them. We talk about America being this huge melting pot. We talk about several cultures coming together, but whiteness actually steals that culture from individuals. And I just wanted to call and really just challenge that thinking and make a plea for education, because some of these things are not being taught in schools. Actually, most of these things are not being taught in school. Whiteness was created as a legal thing to oppress people of color.
Mm. I'm glad you brought that up, Mercy, because that's actually one of the things we wanted to talk about. But it's a topic that actually Colin McEnroe has covered a little bit. So if anybody's interested in hearing a show about whiteness, I encourage you to go to WMPR.org and check out Colin McEnroe's show that he did on that. Again, the number to call, 860-275-7266. The email is wherewelive@WNPR.org. And Facebook and Twitter is at wherewelive. I have one more caller is Walt. Walter from Brantford. Walter, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hey, how are you? So I just wanted to, the previous two callers ago, I believe, talking about where does it end with the statues, I think it's pretty simple. If you have generals of the military that took up arms and tried to fight and destroy the United States, that's a pretty clear line. If you have members of the military who tried and fought bloody, bloody battles to keep people enslaved, that's a pretty clear line. As far as Antifa, you know, I see it bandied about in the press now. It seems like something that, you know, journalists want to make sure they're covering both sides, but it doesn't really exist in the United States. If you see where its origin comes from, and it's another thing that came out of the way journalists covered the Trump campaign, you've got far-right websites talking about things that then percolate into the mainstream media. Sure, it might have been a fringe movement, more about identity and people identifying with a movement or a group in Europe than it is here. But to talk about Antifa as anything but something that comes out of the far-right beaver swamps and really is pushed by the same sources that have been linked to Russian propaganda is really, really a bad and misguided thing, because it just isn't true, and it plays into the far-right's hands of setting up this both sides narrative. Honest Press encourages it. And, you know, there are anti-fascists, but to name it something like Antifa and give it a cute name will allow some sort of a group to percolate that disaffected people who aren't necessarily mentally stable will gravitate to on the left side, and that doesn't get us anywhere.
Walter, thanks for your call. Yeah, we have to go to break soon, but I wanted to get Alicia Brooks and Michael Harriet to weigh in quickly just on some of the comments the callers have been making. Go ahead, Michael.
And I don't want to come off as a defender or a proponent of Antifa, but we all have to remember this false equivalency, because if no white supremacists were in Charlottesville, Antifa wouldn't have been there, right? So there's, you know, when you talk about anti-fascism, it's an easy thing to stamp out if you stamp out fascism, right? So I think that false equivalency, when you talk about Black Lives Matter, I always say there's an easy way to get rid of Black Lives Matter if you stop killing or mistreating black people. So it's a false narrative, because these are groups like the KKK, like the white supremacy movement, the white nationalist movement, they've always been here. And these other things are, however you think about them, they are responses to white supremacy.
Hmm. Alicia, well, can you give me a response real quickly?
I completely agree with Mr. Harriet. No one would have been there had the white supremacists not chosen to show up. Now that they have shown up, it's important for us to show up as well. We don't need to. I don't believe that we need to show up violently, but I do know that we need to show up in force. We need to show up and take a strong statement against, or make a strong statement rather, against white supremacists and say that this will not happen. And I applaud folks who are showing up and saying just that. It moves beyond Charlottesville, as you may know. There are rallies that are scheduled to take place in the Bay Area next week. There are, you know, white supremacists in Richard Spencer is trying to, you know, relaunch his college tour. This thing is not going to just stop. So we really have to be smart about our strategy. I completely agree also with Mr. Harriet pointed out how during the modern American civil rights movement, organizers trained folks in nonviolent resistance. And I will remind us that people didn't think that was a good idea then either until they were organized and trained to do so. And then the strategy turned out to be absolutely brilliant. Not everyone was able to participate in that, and that's okay, and not everyone will be able to participate in nonviolent resistance today, but it's a strategy that can and does work, and it will be especially effective against white supremacists who seek chaos, who seek a spectacle, who seek media attention, and we have got to starve them of that attention.
We got a lot to talk about. We have to leave it there for now. I'm David Roche. I'm in for Lucy Nalpathanchil. When we come back from the break, we'll learn about a creative approach to confronting hate in Germany. You can join the conversation 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive@wnpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm David Roche, in for Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we've been talking about hate, recent gatherings of white nationalists, and how to respond to bigotry. We wanted an overseas perspective on this conversation, so we called Fabian Wickman. He's a case manager at Exit Germany, and he's in charge of public relations and campaigning. He joins us now from Germany to tell us about a creative approach to responding to neo-Nazi marches in his home country. Fabian, welcome to Where We Live.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. So we also joining us from ISDN, the studios in WBHM Birmingham in Alabama, is Michael Harriet. He's a staff writer at The Root. And Leisha Brooks, she's an outreach director for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Again, the number to call for joining this conversation is 860-275-7266. The email is wherewelive@wnpr.org. And you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. So, Fabian, tell us a little bit about the German town of Wunsiedel. Why is it important to neo-Nazis?
Yeah, in this town there was the grave of the second hand of Adolf Hitler, the man called Rudolf Hess, and he's buried there since years ago. Then they put the grave to another place, but neo-Nazis went there every year to think about Rudolf Hess and also Adolf Hitler. So they went there and demonstrate there every year since more than 10, 20 years.
So tell us a little bit about your organization, Exit Germany. What do you guys try to do? What do you try to accomplish?
Exit Germany is something, is a project for people who want to leave the right-wing scene, maybe similar or quite similar to Exit USA. We are offer help for people who have a core motivation to think about something has to be changing in their life. So they used to call us, and we try to help them to leave the scene.
So a couple of years ago, you guys did something interesting with the town of Wunsiedel. Tell us a little bit about what you did. You created a walkathon. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. That was an idea to think about. There are demonstrations, and they are quietly ritualized. So neo-Nazis came to this town, the citizens of this town, do counter protest or maybe do nothing anymore because it's too much to do it every year. So we think about a new communication strategy. So we set up, in German it's called Rechts gegen Rechts. In America it's called Nazis against Nazis. So we said for every meter the neo-Nazis walk in this town, they involuntarily donate 10 euros for exit Germany. So they walk against himself. Their money came from local citizens or local other people there. They donated before the march, and the march was with banners, and we got also bananas saying, okay, to be fit and to walk the whole distance, you have to have bananas. And we put some funny banners on the streets and also signs on the streets saying thanks for maybe 5,000 euros, walk on. So we make a little fun out of it. And after all, we make a short video, and that video goes viral 2014 and now again.
So you basically, you they were marching against themselves. How did you guys come up with that idea?
The idea was to think about how to handle demonstrations, how to bring up a new creative idea. Also to say, there is a narrative of the demonstrators. They're saying, we are here, we are remind Rudolf Hess. And they do what they want to do it in a peaceful and very... way like the Third Reich. So we say, we take this narrative and make something new out of it. So we make a funny story. So there's no glorifying anymore of this Third Reich. Now it's a funny story about dumb neo-Nazis who walked through the town and spent involuntarily 10,000 euros. And the idea is, it's developed next to beer and cigarettes.
Those often lead to the most profound ideas I found. What do you think we can learn in the United States from the work that you guys have been doing?
I don't know. I think there are maybe two major levels. One thing is to think about funny and ironic stories to handle that demonstrations, because there's a need to... need to respond to the main society, to empower the society, to get connected to this society. Maybe satirical stuff is there useful for. But also there is a need for their security, for the police. On the pictures of Charlottesville, I didn't see police dividing the groups. I only see different groups get together, get into conflict, and all that stuff. If you look at Germany, the police try to divide both groups the whole time. And if there is a moment of conflict, the police will get in short and fast and divide these groups. And maybe that's one point, to make sure that there is a counter-protest in the near of the demonstration, but to make also sure that there is now directly confrontation of both groups. Maybe that's one point. I didn't see police. I see police at the end when there was some conflict or when there was an accident, but not in the moment. But it can be also be that I only see a part of it, not the whole situation.
Mm. Well, we only have about a minute left, but I wanted to get Leisha Brooks from the Southern Poverty Law Center to weigh in quickly. Leisha, you have about 30 seconds. Can you just respond? How do we, use satire or things to, or some kind of acerbic humor to address these things?
I think that that's proved to be a very effective means of countering that type of speech, especially with a provocateur like Milo Yiannopoulos or even Richard Spencer. It's also a way for us not to be seen in the larger society as kind of violent protesters. I want to thank our friend in Germany, the Jewish Bar Association in San Francisco, has picked up on what you did and has launched an Adopt a Nazi fundraiser for San Francisco, where they're expecting a protest next week.
Mm. Well, thank you so much, Lisa Brooks from the Southern Poverty Law Center. I also want to thank Michael Harriet, staff writer at The Root. Also, David Blight, a professor of American history at Yale, and our German guest, Fabian Wickman. Thank you so much for joining us. I also want to thank Lydia Brown and Jeff Tyson for producing the show. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. WNPR's executive producer is Katie Talarski. Check out WNPR.org/where we live for more about the show. I'm David DeRoche, and for Lucy Nalpathanchel, and thanks for listening.